From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the Human Rights Campaign Studios in Washington, D.C. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you made a donation this week, thank you. Thank you so much. You're a part of what's going on right now. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can keep the show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On Tuesday, May 21st, Interfaith Alliance hosted the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony in our nation's capital. The celebration coincides with the 25th anniversary of the founding of the organization, and this year's honorees are Judge William H. Webster, former director of the FBI and the CIA, and White House correspondent Peter Mayer. The occasion brought State of Belief back to Washington, D.C., and we were able to record some memorable interviews that you'll be hearing in the coming weeks. In fact, we'll start sharing a couple of them today with the following caveat. Some technical glitches at the studio resulted in the sound quality of the following conversations being less than ideal. In fact, you may choose to imagine them taking place in a stately cathedral. I actually sat down with these guests at the Human Rights Campaign studio, and I am eternally grateful for the warm welcome and hospitality that we receive there. You'll also hear some thoughts from the ceremony on Tuesday. First, though, I wanted to get a briefing on an important step forward for the Bipartisan Equality Act in the House of Representatives. For that, I spoke in our imaginary cathedral with Interfaith Alliance Policy and Legislation Advisor Catherine Joseph. The Equality Act has been a priority for leading faith-based activist groups in Washington and across the nation. This is a case where most people support fairness for all, but too often may assume that these basic protections are in place nationwide already. They are not. The House of Representatives passed the Equality Act last Friday, and Interfaith Alliance Policy and Legislation Advisor Catherine Joseph is back with us. Katie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton. It's great to be with you.
Let's remind folks of what the Equality Act is and what the objective of that legislation would be.
So, as you said, Walton, our nation was founded on the principle that all people are created equal. That ideal calls us to defend liberty and justice for all, with no exceptions. But we know, as a nation, our aspirations don't always correspond to the lived experiences of many Americans. And we currently have no federal laws on the books that protect LGBTQ individuals from discrimination. So that means that, by and large, the issue is up to the states and is a matter of ongoing civil litigation. In roughly 30 states, LGBTQ people and their families live in fear that they may be fired, or denied housing, or turned away from a restaurant, or excused from jury service simply because of who they are and who they love. So I know that jury service doesn't exactly sound like the most exciting exercise of what it means to be an American, but we're talking about everyday people who just want the same chance as everyone else to pursue health and happiness, to earn a living, to be safe in their communities, and to take care of the ones that they love. This is a matter of fairness, and it's a matter of equality. So that's why Congressman David Cicilline of Rhode Island introduced the Equality Act, to ensure that LGBTQ Americans are protected from discrimination wherever they go. The bill also strengthens existing civil rights laws to address how and where discrimination occurs in 2019, including discrimination on the basis of religion. So from the start, the Equality Act had tremendous support from people of faith, and this should come as no surprise. A recent study by the Public Religion Research Institute found that substantial majorities of all major religions in the United States actually supported federal non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people. So at the start of the 116th Congress earlier this year, Interfaith Alliance became a founding member of the Faith for Equality Coalition, a subgroup of the larger coalition of civil rights groups, religious freedom groups, businesses, social service providers, working to pass the Equality Act together. Our working group leading up to this historic vote hosted webinars, developed materials, educated our members and supporters about what the bill does, and we united over 5,000 faith leaders from across the country to engage with their representatives to make sure that Congress knows that people of faith, that leaders in faith communities across the country support this bill, and we're eager to see a favorable vote in the House.
There will be some people listening to us who will say, why is this important to Interfaith Alliance? Because they usually hear Interfaith Alliance talking about religious freedom. Tell us why Interfaith Alliance is so interested in this legislation.
Absolutely. So Interfaith Alliance has a two-part mission. First and foremost, to unite diverse religious and secular voices to protect true religious freedom, and also to provide an alternative faith voice to the religious right, which has only grown in prominence since our founding 25 years ago. And as we were leading up to the vote on the Equality Act in the House, we heard again and again arguments, particularly from the religious right, that this bill was a threat to freedom of belief. Nothing could be further from the truth. The two fundamental American principles that all people are created equal and that we each have the right to believe as we choose are complementary principles. They're not contradictory. And so there is nothing in the Equality Act that would mandate a particular view on human sexuality, on gender identity. The goal of the bill is to ensure that every person is treated with respect and dignity as they go through their everyday lives.
On Friday, May 17th, the House of Representatives voted on this bill. Tell us about the final outcome.
Well, it was an incredibly moving day, to be perfectly honest. Rabbi Moline and I had the honor of being in the House chamber for debate on the bill and for the eventual vote. We were joined by dozens of members of the Faith for Equality Coalition. Many clergy members from across the country came to support the bill and celebrate the final vote. There were very passionate speeches on both sides, both in favor of the bill and in opposition to the bill, for exactly those reasons that I laid out, often making the false argument that this is an intrusion on religious freedom. But we also heard from many of the supporters on the bill who spoke about their own faith. And affirm the inherent dignity and worth of all people and the calling of our government to extend the rights and protections of our non-discrimination laws to all Americans. So it was very moving for me in the gallery to hear that expression of my own faith beliefs given voice within the House of Representatives.
Well, what do you feel like listening to those? I mean, you were moving toward the moment of the vote. What was going on inside?
There was a real sense of excitement in the room. I think that we took our seats up in the gallery maybe around 9 o'clock that morning. The votes to move the bill forward began maybe around 11:30. Mm-hmm. So we'd been sitting there for a long time. We had heard a lot of back and forth, some very passionate speeches on both sides. And there was a tremendous amount of work that went into engaging both staunch supporters of the Equality Act and some potential swing votes who had never spoken up on this issue or had asked follow-up questions about this bill to make sure that when the time came, they would hopefully vote in support of it. So there was a little bit of concern, anticipation, some questions in the air about how this is going to go. But when the time finally came for a vote on the bill, over the course of the morning, Congress members had been slowly making their way to the chamber. We started out with, I don't know, maybe 40 people on the floor. Mm-hmm. By the time they were getting ready to vote, folks were standing in the aisles. It was absolutely packed. So there was a real sense of anticipation. And there were about 5 minutes where all of the members of the House registered their votes on electronic devices so they don't go up to the front and say their vote in a microphone anymore. There's a scoreboard, almost like you're at a baseball game, and you can watch in real time as votes are registered. And we watched those numbers tick up both in favor and opposed to the bill over the course of 5 minutes. And finally, at the close of those 5 minutes, the final vote was 236 votes in favor of the Equality Act and 173 opposed. So it passed with a sizable majority. And I think it's worth saying that among the votes in favor of the bill, there was bipartisan support.
Were coalition partners there?
They were. Many of our coalition partners were there. There was a real broad sense of support from across the faith community in moving this bill forward. Over 70 national organizations, faith-based organizations, spoke up to support this bill, ranging from the Hindu American Foundation to the Rabbinical Assembly to the United Methodist Church Division on Church and Society. So there was a real broad representation of engagement and activity in support of this bill.
Why was presence so important? Was it just because you wanted to be there, or was there the presence had something to do with talking to Congress by your presence? And I know you did want to be there, but why was the presence really important?
I think that it's important for people of faith who support non-discrimination protections, who support true religious freedom and the separation of religion and government, to be physically present in the space, to engage their legislators, to make sure that there is an alternative narrative for what people of faith believe and stand for in this country. I think, unfortunately, the religious right has been very effective in developing a fluency and a familiarity in outlining their view on what religious freedom is. Over the past decades, there has not always been the same fluency among those who would advance the same separation between religion and government that Interfaith Alliance stands for. And so it's very important for us to be there to provide that alternative voice.
What are the next steps?
The next steps, well, the bill has passed the House. It will now go to the Senate. It remains to be seen whether the bill will be taken up by the Senate. But as we move forward, we've created incredibly strong, incredibly effective coalitions within the faith community, within the business community, across civil rights organizations that work on a real range of issues to ensure that when the time comes for this bill to be heard in the Senate, that we can speak in a unified voice in support of the Equality Act. Yeah.
There are some reports that the administration was not supporting this initiative. And do you think the Senate is or will not really work on it passionately like you all have, or will they just set it aside?
Well, I can't speak to the motivations behind this administration. What we have seen, particularly around the rights of LGBTQ+ in the United States, is a concerted attack, unfortunately, by the administration to roll back many of the protections that are currently in place to jeopardize the health care that LGBTQ people can access, protections for young people in schools who want to make sure they can use the bathroom that corresponds with their gender, that they're called by the appropriate names. And so I will say that I was not tremendously surprised to see that the president did not stand up in support of this bill. But I think that the groundswell of support and the vocal support from so many different constituencies to move this forward tells me that we are moving in the right direction and that the progression of history will take us to a place where LGBTQ people are protected and afforded the same rights as all Americans in the near future.
What did you learn? Did you learn anything that surprised you or something that really disappointed you? Or did you find in going through this piece of legislation something that might be of really help to you as you go into other legislation?
I think that what this process reaffirmed for me is the importance of working across movements to advance shared goals.
Yeah.
So within the Equality Act coalition that included so many of these civil rights organizations, religious freedom organizations, social service providers, there are a lot of different priorities just because we're all working on so many different things at the same time.
Yeah.
But there were some really necessary and important conversations that had to happen along the way to ensure that existing civil rights protections were strengthened under the Equality Act. That LGBTQ people who are also people of color were protected in all aspects of their identities and that they were an integral part, a central part of this movement, that people of faith were a central part of this movement, many of whom who spoke up very vocally as part of the Faith for Equality Coalition are LGBTQ themselves. When we work in silos, we ultimately limit what we can accomplish on a particular issue. When we work together across movements, we ensure that all of us can eventually be free.
Good. Great insight. Would you quickly say what's on the Interfaith Alliance agenda over, say, the next 2 or 3 months of summer?
Well, summer is probably not going to be an especially quiet time at Interfaith Alliance. As I'm sure many of your listeners know, we are keeping a very close eye on a recent increase in states that are looking to pass restrictions on reproductive rights. Reproductive rights is not an issue that Interfaith Alliance works on directly. But much of the push behind these bills is rooted in a particular religious perspective on the issue of abortion. So we've seen bills pass in Mississippi, Ohio, Iowa, Georgia, Alabama, Kentucky, Arkansas, and Utah. So that's millions of people who may have a different religious belief around pregnancy, around access to abortion, than is now reflected in their state government. And to be clear, that's an infringement on their religious freedom. That is the government imposing a particular religious perspective on the personal decisions of residents of that state. And that's a real issue of concern for us. I expect that Interfaith Alliance will be looking at this larger trend through a religious freedom lens and galvanizing our members, our partners, those who are increasingly affected by these bills to push back and provide a vision of religious freedom that allows each of us to follow our beliefs and make the choices that are right for us.
Catherine Joseph is Policy and Legislation Advisor at Interfaith Alliance. Katie, it's great to be in the same room with you, and I appreciate so much the work that you're doing. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Walton.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll get some highlights from this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. On Tuesday, May 21st, Interfaith Alliance honored Judge William H. Webster, former director of the FBI and the CIA, and acclaimed CBS News White House correspondent Peter Mayer with the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. Here's some of what those attending the event heard.
We gather this evening sensitive to all that is holy, and grateful for the sources of empowering love and the mandate for assuring justice. Memories cause us to look over our shoulders and be filled with gratitude for visionaries who saw the need for an interfaith alliance and started it. For a man by the name of Walter Cronkite, who encouraged us in our commitment as well as modeled for all the kind of honesty and trust he expected of us. For the variety of individuals who have received an honor in Mr. Cronkite's name, like the two special people who will receive the Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award this evening. Memories usher us into realities of this moment that make us aware of the necessity of the ongoing work of this organization to cherish and defend religious freedom as defined in the First Amendment to our Constitution, and to assure access to that freedom for people of all religions and for all people who embrace no religion. Let us see clearly what is around us so that we will recognize the need for strength in our lobby for civility, tirelessness in our assurance of diversity, unrelenting in our support for a free press, never failing in our work for democracy, and deeply devoted to the essential value of honesty. Memories and realities usher us into commitments. As we enjoy our fellowship with one another this evening and honor as well as celebrate two people who have faithfully and courageously blazed new trails as they embodied our national promise resident in our Constitution, sensitize all of us to the necessity of the mission and work of Interfaith Alliance, and embolden within each of us a desire to do our fair share of working for unity in our nation, fellowship with our neighbors, and peace in our world. With memories, realities, and commitments, we dream. How good it would be for us to live so that with smiles on our faces, we could borrow Walter's words and say to each other this evening, and that's the way it is. On May 21, 2019, or if you please, amen.
Welcome, my friends, to the 2019 Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony from the Interfaith Alliance. My name is Jack Moline. I am the president of Interfaith Alliance. The Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award recognizes those whose courageous actions embody the values of civility, tolerance, and cooperation in the advancement of public dialogue and public policy on traditionally controversial issues. In addition to being a respected journalist and one of the most trusted men in America, Walter Cronkite was a committed supporter of the Interfaith Alliance Foundation. He joined our organization because, as he said, nothing less is at stake in the work of the Interfaith Alliance than the existence of democracy as we know it. Walter Cronkite served as the honorary chair of Interfaith Alliance from 1997 until his death in 2009. The Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award honors individuals of faith and goodwill who stand up for religious freedom and demonstrate the constructive force of religion, faith, and conscience in American life. And with that, may I invite Judge William Webster to join me on the stage.
Well, thank you very much. I'm deeply moved and honored to have been extended this recognition. What this organization does is of importance to our society and to mankind. The idea that individuals should be free and encouraged to pursue their highest callings, I think, is important and needs to be preserved and expanded wherever that is possible. You know, we tend to play around with adjectives and lawyers and words from time to time in public life, and we throw words around that don't have lasting meaning. And something about what you have said tonight, and something about what I understand is involved here, makes me think of the experience that I had, for which I have been warmly remembered by an organization that I revered and tried to support, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, and others. And it has to do with when I was sworn in 1978 to that position, I knew that I would have to respond to a lot of accusations, comments, arguments out in the public arena in a way that would at least be positive and they would understand where I stood on those. And I ended with a statement which resulted in the FBI's incorporation of that statement in a 80-pound bronze medallion that incorporated that at the time I was sworn in. The statement was this: together, we will do the work that the American people expect of us, and in the way that the Constitution demands of us. I have a photograph of that bronze medallion hanging in my office to be a continual reminder of a pledge that I made, and which I think incorporates the spirit of the Faith Alliance, which you represent here so well, and for which I am so deeply grateful and appreciative. Thank you so very much.
You're hearing some highlights from this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards.
I now have the great personal pleasure to introduce the co-recipient of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, our honoree and my friend, Peter Mayer.
Well, I am humbled, but I'm also, when I use that word, I'm very cautious because I always think of an anecdote about the Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir. It has been lost in history to whom she was addressing this, but it was either Moshe Dayan or some visiting diplomat who came to the podium after being introduced, and she followed up by saying, "Don't be so humble because you weren't so great to begin with." But I am humbled. My gratitude goes to everyone at the Alliance and to our many Muslim friends who are here tonight and anywhere we say Ramadan Kareem. I accept this wonderful honor in the names of five people. My grandchildren, I hope and pray that all of us and them, Joshua, Levi, Orly, Shira, and Talia, will always live in times of faith and freedom and true interfaith alliance. There's your Kleenex moment. I'm beyond proud to be with you, Judge Webster, as we had the opportunity to tell you in your office last week, a visit that I will never, ever forget. This evening, I feel like I'm the personification of that game, What or Who Does Not Belong in This Picture? I was a rookie reporter in our shared hometown area of St. Louis when he was first nominated to become U.S. Attorney, when he went to the federal bench, and I covered some of the cases that he heard and rendered judgment on. Fast forward here to Washington, and I found myself reporting on the day that Jimmy Carter named you to head the FBI, and then when I was on the White House beat when President Reagan named you to be director of the CIA. Judge Webster, thank you. I know it's been said already, it can't be said enough, for all you have done to give us the faith that our cherished freedoms will be preserved. This is also a moment to salute Linda, Linda Webster, for all you've done for the community and for the nation through your many ongoing charitable endeavors. There are so many that it would be the rest of the evening to note all of them. Now, on a personal note, I told my friend, CBS News President Susan Zirinsky, that receiving this extraordinary award and another honor that's modestly going to be coming my way in a few weeks, that this is all like reading what we used to call an HFR, a hold for release, advance copy of my own obituary. Susan advised me that in these lifetime achievement moments, one should just say thank you and ask, am I dead? So I'm going to pinch myself to confirm that I am still here and share a few more thoughts. Again, I'm humbled and honored to receive this award that carries the name of my hero, Walter Cronkite. He was, as Rabbi Moline said, a major influence in all of my time in broadcast journalism. I was about 8 years old, maybe a little younger, when I decided that I wanted to become a newspaper reporter. Then came January 22nd, 1963, and the assassination of President Kennedy. And like so many other people, I was riveted to the coverage of Walter Cronkite and absolutely inspired by the immediacy and accuracy of his reporting on the President Kennedy assassination. His endorsement of the goals of Interfaith Alliance and our friendship and respect for Rabbi Moline led my wife Elizabeth and me to support the Alliance's mission. Thank you, Elizabeth, for being at my side for 47 years. I was probably on the road for about 19. Thanks to Jonathan, our son Jonathan, and daughter-in-law Michelle, and to our daughter Beth, and son-in-law Harley Magden. I'm forever grateful to my mother. You mentioned her. She's back in St. Louis, hopefully watching on the live stream tonight. She and my late dad, Dr. Stanley Mayer, instilled the importance of faith and freedom early on. I remember it well. A deeply sincere thank you to all my friends and family who are here tonight. I would like to mention everyone here, each and every one of you, but I think I'd get in trouble with you, Rabbi Moline, and that would be a bad thing. I do want to thank all of my friends at CBS News who continue to uphold the traditions of Walter Cronkite. For representing the family, a special shout out to Walt Cronkite. Thank you to Southern Illinois University Vice Chancellor Rachel Stack, who is here representing my alma mater. Very special. Now, for those of you looking at me right now and having listened to me for a few moments and saying that guy doesn't have a prayer, my rabbi, David Callender from Congregation Olam Tikva, is here. Rabbi Callender from Olam Tikva in Fairfax. Thank you, Rabbi. Now, growing up in Granite City, Illinois, speaking of my religion, I was the only Jewish kid in a class, a high school class, of 800. It was there that I learned the importance of interfaith alliances, and I'm proud to say that many of those alliances are still an important part of my life today. We're still in touch. So that personal history is the foundation of my support for Interfaith Alliance. Its core missions are perhaps more important now than at any time in your 25 years of protecting faith and freedom. Now, I have faith, and I know that most of you do too, hopefully all of you, that our freedoms will endure despite the challenges to our values, to our traditions and ideals that sadly we're seeing from the highest level of government. But we need more than faith. We need the steadfast efforts of Interfaith Alliance and like-minded organizations and individuals to ensure that those cherished freedoms are protected and strengthened. As the great theologian and civil rights leader Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said, the opposite of good is not evil, the opposite of good is indifference. Rabbi Heschel, who marched with Martin Luther King in Selma, stated that in a free society where terrible wrongs exist, some are guilty, but all are responsible. And to quote Walter Cronkite, as the Reverend did, that's the way it is. Thank you.
We've got time for a few more minutes of highlights from this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards given by Interfaith Alliance.
One person in this room has extraordinary privilege right now to ply his trade with someone he admires greatly, and the rest of us have the almost as extraordinary privilege to be part of this conversation between Peter Mayer and Judge William Webster.
Since you are the only person in the history of the United States who served as FBI and CIA director, I want to ask you, you're among friends, nothing's going to leave the room. Do you have any secrets that you'd like to share with us?
That's very tempting.
I'll rescue you.
Thank you.
Because I do have a secret that I hope you'll reveal.
All right.
And that is, how does someone who just within the past couple of months celebrated his 95th birthday stay so vital and so secure and so busy and important? You were playing tennis until recently, right?
I was, but you know, it's the privilege to sit here and talk to an audience like this that makes it all seem worthwhile.
All right, we'll carry on then. In something of an understatement, the American Bar Association said that you embody the maxim of so much can be done with a law degree. You brought your experience being a veteran of World War II, Korea, private law practice, of course, before you became U.S. attorney, your federal judgeship, director of the CIA and the FBI. Yet in our conversation in your office the other day, you kept emphasizing the word character when you talked about the people at the FBI and at the CIA. I wonder if you could elaborate on that, why that character resonated with you so deeply.
Well, they stood out because of it as compared with some of the other organizations where that was not as readily apparent. But I think I want to watch, not that I'm not attempted to make a sermon here.
Go ahead.
But it is the thing that has always impressed me and warmed my cockles of my heart, if that's the right way to put it, that when I got to know people who I felt weren't immune to mistakes, but who wanted very much to do the right thing in the right way. That's what I referred to my little 80-pound medallion about, because it was in that trying that I think we make the difference between our other societies. And I think both the CIA and the FBI attempt to encourage and inculcate that, sometimes one more than the other, but that was what I always felt, that they were there. They were not trying to see how far they could go or what they could do or what they could avoid doing that they knew they should do, but to do the right thing in the right way. And I think that's totally consistent with the Interfaith Alliance.
Absolutely. And that is the very character, literally the complexion of the FBI. You know, you inherited although there were several directors between you and J. Edgar Hoover, you inherited an agency where, according to a little bit of research that I did, there were about 100 women and minority agents in the Bureau at that time. And when you left, that had increased about 13-fold. So many of us growing up, some of us heard the old radio show, the FBI in War and Peace, and we saw Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. as Inspector Louis Erskine on the FBI TV show, and we had this image of FBI agents in starched white shirts and their hair combed a certain way. What led you to want to change that?
Well, I don't think I claim credit for changing it, but I wanted them to think about themselves in a way that encompassed the opportunities for women and other minorities of type in the organization who could make a serious and permanent contribution. And we talked about it, and we built out from there, and it seemed to work.
It certainly did. And the Bureau today looks very much like America, right?
Right.
You read the wording from your medallion, and I'll just repeat it quickly because it leads into my question. Together, we will do the American people expect of us, in the way that the Constitution demands of us. It seems to me that this quote should be required reading for people in every branch of government these days. And I'm wondering, do you think that the current executive and legislative branches are doing what you said in that statement? Are they doing the work that the public expects and the Constitution demands?
Well, it's a little unfair to make a judgment on the basis of current events that are happening. I don't think you could take a current event as an indication of a basic change or diminishing of proper attitude. I think that it's time to pause and look at what we're doing and for people to speak out in favor of the traditional values that all of us here share and would prefer. And I think that most of these organizations will respond to it. The leadership will be more willing to respond to it. And that's about as far as I dare calculate the future here.
What do you think the best way, the best vehicles are for people and organizations to speak out about the ideals that are embodied in that statement that you made that's emblazoned on that medallion?
Well, I'm going to plead avoidance here, because I don't have a quick answer to that, but it's there. It's there. Even the ones that are heavy tempered are not immune from thinking about what is right in the system of government that we value and revere, and we want our law enforcement and other people on whom we depend for protection and help to think about those things and to stand up for them, and I think they will. I really believe they will.
You wrote in a New York Times opinion piece last summer, in July of last year, that we should not run down our own institutions, trivialize the impartial actions of our own grand juries, degrade our own justice system, or bully a free press for doing its job. And you warned that we do so at our own peril. I asked you this in your office the other day, just so you'd know that I was going to touch on it. And this will be the last current events question that I bring up, because after all, once a judge, always a judge, right? But, you know, what goes through the mind of the only man to head the FBI and the CIA when you hear the President of the United States criticize the judgment of the fine, dedicated people that work in those agencies, even calling FBI agents dirty cops?
Well, obviously, it doesn't warm your heart, and it's disappointing. particularly for people who have the ability and the intellect to know better. But I think that that at the same time, we've got to be careful to make sure that they are made aware of the damage that they're doing and encourage them to be true leaders for this country in the spirit of our country and what it stands for. And you can do that.
Absolutely. Few people have worked with and for as many presidents as you have, men of both parties. And I hope you might share your thoughts on each of them, because I know that you have some really special observations about each of them, starting with President Carter, who named you to head the FBI.
Well, we were of opposite political affiliations. I'm going to say avoid the word term faith. We've got a better word for it. I was complimented that he thought that I would be able to do the job and do the job right. I was impressed by his personal character and his deep faith and a feeling I had that he wanted to do the right thing in the right way. And I think he wasn't as outspoken and he wasn't looking for headlines. He was just doing his job. And it made it a great pleasure for me to work for him.
What are your thoughts about President Reagan? He named you to lead the CIA.
Well, the president at that point in time needed someone that he felt was sufficiently copus mentis and stabilized, whatever it would be. And he asked if I would go over. They were having problems getting a successor and who it would be. So
this, of course, for anyone young in the audience, was after the Iran-Contra affair and some other difficulties at the CIA. You went in to clean it up.
Well, I was complimented, but it was. I think those of us who are privileged to engage in public service, particularly in law enforcement and intelligence, are very sensitive of a desire to do something worth doing, not just be there. This is work, and it's challenging, and it has its heartbreaks. Most of the time, the comfort was knowing you were trying to do the right thing in the right way, and that's the spirit of our modern law enforcement. I'm very pleased about that.
I just knew that you'd talk about President Bush 41 in your remarks tonight, because he's got some great pictures in his office with President George H.W. Bush. And full disclosure, we have a shared deep affection and respect for President Bush 41. My wife and I saw him not too long, within a matter of months before he died. He invited us to see him at Kennebunkport, Maine, and we had a marvelous visit. What was it about that man that affected you so deeply?
You want one word? In my experience, George Herbert Walker Bush was the most decent man in public life that was ever my privilege to work with. So decency is the word and decency plays a huge role in among leadership in the government, is how you treat people. If you spot a very decent person, you're on your way to success.
When you consider all of your experiences in and out of government, your own faith beliefs and so forth, what are your thoughts and hopes of where the country is heading at, frankly, is an uncertain time at the moment?
Well, we're really in an uncertain time right now, and so whatever I say is not intended to be preaching, but to say, what are my hopes? And my hopes are that those who have been given either electoral victories or appointments and confirmed and in place to do a job will try their very best to perpetuate those parts of our society that are working well, and will work hard to correct those that aren't, and will not tolerate an indifference or a disrespect for the responsibility that they have. When you take a job, you take a responsibility, and you're at risk if you ignore those responsibilities for legitimate public criticism and correction.
Rabbi?
I will ask both of you this question and ask you for a brief answer to a complicated question. What's the difference between an interview and an interrogation?
I'm going to give you that opportunity.
Thank you. I think probably some of the politicians I covered would say I was involved in some interrogations, but I don't think I was ever involved in an interrogation. I think that I certainly did report on the results of interrogations over the years, but to me, an interview as a reporter is to find out, you know, basically what I always asked myself was, what would the people back in Granite City want to know about this when I would sit down with anyone and sort of use that as my barometer so I wouldn't get stuck and strangled inside the Beltway. But, you know, just to me, an interview was always meant to elicit what things meant to people's lives and what how things affected them. That, you know, that didn't preclude me from asking some tough questions over the years. Mike McCurry, President Clinton's press secretary, is here. Where are you, Mike? You can attest to that. So thank you for being here. And I also wanted to say what an incredible honor it is for me to be in the same room with Mr. Kaiser Khan. You are truly a treasure, and thank you very much.
That's a very good answer, and I don't want to extend the time too much, but I'll throw in a couple of thoughts. An interview is legitimately a search for truth. Interrogation comes when their answers are subject to question and an effort to find by other means what is the truth. You may say, what are the facts? I like to say, what is the truth? It's the truth that makes us free.
Well, that's a highlight from this year's Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards, honoring Judge William H. Webster, former director of the FBI and the CIA, and CBS News White House correspondent Peter Mayer. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital, vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.